I am Dr. Graham MacDonald, and I work in the Department of English and Comparative Literary Studies. I'm an associate professor there, and I teach modern and contemporary literature and drama. We can stretch the idea of what we understand literature to be. We tend in this country to immediately nationalise it and think about it as something that is English or Scottish or British. And the recent moves in globalisation across the world, in culture, in the economy, in politics, have pressurised those national outlooks somewhat and forced many people who work within those rubrics to think about how they relate to the wider world. So I guess we're thinking about the movement between national literatures, international literatures, transnational connections between different literary formations, and generally how we can see the most local of literatures as always irrepressibly global on some level. Any piece of work that, say for example, has a migrant in it, maybe first generation, second generation, third generation migrants, so maybe a novel about, say, West Indians in Britain in the 1950s, or a novel about Southeast Asians in London in the 1990s, has an immediate global impact, in the sense that migration itself is a thing that affects every territory on the earth, even those with hardly any migrants whatsoever. It's clearly something that goes beyond the borders of national culture as well as national polities, and you can imagine that type of global subject as being utterly crucial and probably most comprehensible from a much wider frame of reference than the national. All those levels, political, psychological, cultural, are all bound up, say for example, in the figure of the migrant, but also in the figure of the person that the migrant lives next to, who may conceive himself as solely of that country, as such the home country. And of course most of the literature that circulates around migration, for example, deals with that encounter. It deals with the stresses as well as the possibilities that come from the encounter between the standing person, shall we say, and the incomer as such. And in fact, it's oftentimes the fact and the case that the standing person learns more about where they come from than the migrant learns about the space that they've moved into. So in a sense, we learn more about what we might call our, what we understand to be sovereignty, what we understand to be our relation to our local environment, through the opening of our eyes to the wider world. What we do to that wider world, how we become part of it through our voting patterns, through our language and so on and so forth, and how that wider world comes to us all the time, even when we do not notice it in our everyday movements, the things that we purchase, how we get to work, what we wear, and so on and so forth. I teach modern British literature, and one of the most revealing works on contemporary British history that I read as part of my research for modern British literature was a book about North Sea oil. And the slightest chapter in that book was on oil culture. And the argument was that this was one of the most important substances for the history of modern Britain. And yet, it hardly registers in the literature and culture of the country from the 1970s onwards. It's hardly there. It's in the northeastern fringes of Scotland, as you might expect, but even there, hardly even registers at all. And I asked myself, why is that, right? Why is this most crucial and toxic of modern substances, a brilliant thing as much as an awful thing, not even registered explicitly in the cultural production of Great Britain? And therefore, I thought, well, okay, that got me thinking. What about other oil spaces around the world? And the same kind of event happened as such. You know, like the location of oil was apparent in some oil-producing countries, but in those countries, especially those on the periphery, in those countries where oil was utterly superabundant and required and necessary for modern living, such as, say, the US or Canada as such, the same thing happened. It was kind of offshore. It didn't really appear in some of the mainstream literature. So that got me thinking, okay, what is it about the relationship between this most crucial of modern substances and culture. It's often measured in petrodollars or combustion power, but it's never really seen as a social thing, as something that we are acculturated to. And what I mean by that is, the likelihood is you might be watching this film on a tablet or a computer or a mobile phone that requires an oiliness to be even made, to even make its appearance into your hand. You might be watching it at your place of work or leisure or your house that requires energy at all times. So we are oily people, right? We're all saturated in the modern world system in this most toxic and brilliant of substances. And that kind of contradiction is crucially a cultural contradiction, I think, as much as it's one for science or engineering to work out. So I look at a bunch of novels from all over the world which seem to have similar oil characteristics, and I call them petrofiction because they're made from and they're about oil. From the point of view of, say, energy, we have a trilemma. We have a problem of sustainability, we have a problem of future security, but the third part of that trilemma is equality. We cannot progress with the energy that we use in abundance right now, say fossil fuels, and clearly climate change is directly linked to that. So the further contradiction we have in terms of the trilemma is the fact that we have utterly rising demand across the world, and that needs, in some sort of respect, supplied, right, and consumed. So we consume more of it than ever before, and these countries across the world are looking at superabundant fossilized countries already and saying, why can't we have the same? So the problem of equality in terms of energy rights has been crucial in terms of the claim for modernity to countries all over the globe. And that's something I think that permeates a lot of the social arguments about the type of energy that we should be using, but also the arguments about why climate change itself is not necessarily just or primarily a scientific phenomenon. So the idea of eco-socialism, of course, is the notion of equal rights to all and access to all for energy, to equal rights and equal access to all for a cleaner environment. And in a sense, it's a political effect of some of the environmental justice movements that grew up in the 1970s and strengthened in the 1980s. And in a sense, some of it is in the modern Green Party and in green politics. And many eco-socialists, I guess, would argue that it has to transcend that, that it has to be right at the front and centre of every move we make politically, economically, culturally in the country, in the countries across the world right now, as we configure ourselves towards a problematic, unsustainable future. My first degree is a degree in sociology, anthropology, and literature. I grew up through my own university with those three subjects, and I carried on through my doctoral work with those three subjects in tandem. And the thing I think exciting about them is the degree to which they inform each other. Whenever I read a novel, I think of the sociological work that I've read or the anthropological work I've read. And also, sometimes when they don't get on, it's good to try as a thought problem, as an intellectual problem, to try to bring them together and work out what the relationship is between one and the other when they're not all that apparent. Now, my work on energy and on petroculture has now formed under a wider rubric, which is just a very recent intellectual enterprise calling itself the Energy Humanities. And their argument is that this problem of energy, as well as the opportunity that it holds, wider than one subject. Only by getting all these subjects together into some kind of coalition can we really understand and overcome some of the issues that are coming down the pipe, so to speak, from the threat of a toxic future. And interdisciplinarity has been utterly part of that whole endeavour. The argument is, of course, that environmental studies is something that can't just exist through one discipline alone. And it's incumbent and it's challenging on quite a lot of levels to try to juggle all these disciplines together. But ultimately, it's rewardable. And it's only sustainable because of that endeavour.
This podcast was recorded and edited by Andy Mahaney. Music by Bensound.